From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Film Week. Welcome, I'm Larry Mantle. I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire and Angie Hahn. They'll review the new Denzel Washington crime thriller, The Little Things, co-starring Rami Malek and Jared Leto. We've got two films from England, the horror movie St. Maud, starring Jennifer Ely, and The Dig, starring Kerry Mulligan and Ralph Fiennes. This time of year, we typically see international films vying for Oscar consideration. This week, those submissions come from Japan, Ukraine, and Georgia. The HBO documentary Fake Famous asks whether it's possible to take typical Angelenos and turn them into social media influencers. By the way, we're listening to Anton Karas' score for the 1949 classic The Third Man. It's Film Week right after NPR News. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a treat to have you with us. We appreciate it very much. I'm joined this week by critics Christy Lemire and Angie Hahn. Angie is film critic and deputy entertainment editor at Mashable. Christy Lemire is film critic for KPCC and RogerEbert.com as well, and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast. We begin with the British horror film St. Maud, which stars Jennifer Ely and Morvid Clark. The film is written and directed by Rose Glass in her feature directorial debut. Angie, please start us off on St. Maud.
I was very impressed by this one, all the more because, as you mentioned, it is Glass's directorial debut. It's one of those movies that reminds me of a lot of other movies. I think some of the obvious references are like Carrie, Taxi Driver, Repulsion, but it comes together into something that feels wholly itself. It's not just, you know, kind of a lazy pastiche. It's totally gripping from start to finish. Morvid Clark is impossible to look away from and just totally transforms into this role to the point where I did not remember that I had ever seen her in anything else, even though I have. And Jennifer Ely makes Amanda, the character that she's playing, feel like such a complex character in her own right and not just an accessory to Maud's story. The dynamic between them is so fascinating as Maud wants to save Amanda's soul and Amanda is maybe not as into that. And I really appreciated that Glass is very deliberate about what she chooses to show and not show. I think she does a great job of walking the line between being like too vague and over-explaining. So I think it's a really exciting debut. I really enjoyed this one.
Do you have any information about where Glass came from in terms of previous non-feature film? Right, because to do a horror film and to do it so well, you know, right out of the gate, that's a challenge.
I'm sorry to say, I actually don't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to know what the formative professional experiences were. We're talking about the horror film St. Maud from the UK. Christy, what did you think?
It is excellent. And by the way, Rose Glass has done some shorts prior to this, but okay. This is her first feature. This is the kind of movie that made me so miss the theatrical experience, because watching this by myself at 11 o'clock in the morning on my couch with just my dog sitting next to me is not the same. I mean, I was completely gripped by it, but it's the kind of movie that you want to be in a packed theater and you want to grab the arm of the person next to you and you want to cringe and squirm all together and just gasp all together. So, you know, hopefully one of these days we can all get back and do that kind of thing. But yeah, there's such mastery of mood and tone going on here. Morvid Clark plays this young woman who is this nurse who is very pious and clearly has had some kind of religious transformation that is all consuming to her. And as she's caring for Jennifer Ely, who is this former choreographer and dancer, it's this incredible clash of personalities. And as you go along, increasingly, you don't know what is real and what is, you know, in her hallucination. It is absolutely terrifying. Morvid Clark has a huge range to show in terms of who this young woman is now, who she was, who she hopes to be, and the tenuous grasp she has on reality. And Jennifer Ely, like, does not get to do that many roles that are, you know, kind of leading roles or this kind of juicy supporting role. And she should. She's Meryl Streep level great every single time. And so when she gets a chance to have a really meaty supporting role like this, it's so exciting to see. This is thrilling and terrifying and beautifully shot. And yeah, I dug it.
Saint Maud is the film. It's rated R. And speaking of the theatrical experience, the drive-in will have to do, but it sounds like a good drive-in film as well. The Vineland Drive-In in City of Industry is showing Saint Maud from writer-director Rose Glass. The crime thriller The Little Things is set in Los Angeles. It stars Denzel Washington, Rami Malek, and Jared Leto. The film is written and directed by John Lee Hancock. Christy, what did you think of The Little Things?
So this is a film that's been kicking around for about 30 years now, and it really shows. It feels very dated. John Lee Hancock wrote this in like 1993, and originally Steven Spielberg was supposed to direct it. At various times, Clint Eastwood was attached to it, and now it's finally coming out. It also feels dated because it takes place in 1990, and it takes place, you know, not too long after The Night Stalker, and it's kind of playing on the rampant fear and paranoia that existed in Southern California during that time. So Denzel Washington plays this sheriff's deputy in Kern County who has to come back down to the LA Sheriff's Department to work part of a murder case he's working on, but it brings him back to where he used to be and back to the reasons that he left under, you know, suspicious circumstances. And he teams up reluctantly with Rami Malek, who now has his old job as the head of the homicide division. And it's sort of a clash of personalities. And they're after a serial killer. And it kind of feels like a really like starry version of a CSI episode. You know, it's a very kind of safe and predictable procedural. The banter is all snappy from the detectives giving each other grief about things. And then Jared Leto shows up from an entirely different movie, apparently, because whereas the whole movie's got like a slow kind of simmer to it, he is chewing up the scenery. And I don't know what direction he got or what he felt he needed to do to bring this role to life, but it is distracting.
We're talking about The Little Things, the crime thriller from Christy. Angie, what'd you think of the movie?
I think Christy really nailed it. To me, this felt very David Fincher light. Like if you take Seven and you carve off everything that makes it interesting and original and complicated and difficult, then you basically have this, which, as she put it, is kind of like a star-studded CSI episode. I will say Denzel Washington is pretty good. It's the kind of role he can do in his sleep, but it's also the kind of role where you're like, there's a reason he still gets called for roles like this. But I am also with Christy on Jared Leto just being, once he enters the movie, I think it just starts to go off the rails, just completely runs out of steam. He's doing such a self-consciously obnoxious, weird thing that it comes all the way back around to just seeming very mundane, if that makes sense. It's like, instead of being a creepy weirdo, he is someone who is trying, like, an actor who is telling you, I'm playing a creepy weirdo. I'm Jared Leto. Look at me. I'm being so wacky. So I found him to be not even a little bit scary, just very irritating. And I think by the end, I was just ready for it to go, especially because toward the end, the plot beats get more and more predictable. I think even telling you what movies the end reminds me of would be giving away a big spoiler, because that's how derivative it feels. So I think the throwback quality might be an appeal for some people because, you know, sometimes you're in the mood for a star-studded CSI episode. But to me, it was kind of like, look, if I'm going to watch something this old feeling and this familiar seeming, I'm just gonna watch one of those other movies again.
The Little Things is rated R, starring Denzel Washington, Rami Malek, and Jared Leto. It's written and directed by John Lee Hancock. You can see it on the screens of the Paramount Drive-In, the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair, and the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside. Or for subscribers of HBO Max, The Little Things is also streaming on that service. The British film The Dig takes us to the historically significant archaeological site of Sutton Hoo in England. Carey Mulligan stars, Ralph Fiennes and Lily James are in the cast. Simon Stone directed the film, which is written by Moira Bufani. Angie, what'd you think of The Dig?
This one really crept up on me. And in the beginning, I was like, okay, it's fine. I'm not super into it, but whatever. And then as it was going on, I was like, I think I'm getting more into it. And then by the end, I was really unexpectedly moved. It's a drama set in 1939, so just as England is about to enter World War II. And it follows Carey Mulligan, Mrs. Pretty, who owns a big estate and she has some property that she would like excavated because she thinks there's probably some kind of find back there. And she's right, as discovered by Ray Fiennes, who plays Basil Brown, the excavator and archaeologist. It's very stereotypically British stiff upper lippy in that, you know, a lot of it is people talking around the thing they want to talk about. A lot of it is people repressing and trying not to express their feelings. And it has a very gentle tone for a lot of it, but that's almost why it's more effective at the end. As the movie goes on, you see more and more of the war is kind of in the background. You see it coming more and more to the foreground. And then it becomes this quite moving film about what, about how and why to carry on when the world seems like it's about to end. It's very bittersweet, and I think something a lot of people can relate to right now. It's not without its flaws. I think that the central relationship between Brown and Pretty is oddly ill-defined, which might have to do with the fact that in real life, the character Carrie Mulligan is playing was in her 50s, and she was actually 5 years older than the Ray Fiennes character, which is a very odd choice. But yeah, ultimately, it really worked for me.
The Dig, a British drama that's streaming on Netflix. Christy.
I really like this too. And as Angie says, it looks like a very stuffy and refined period piece. You know, all the aesthetic trappings of the manor and the clothes are all just so. But the performances are really strong. And it's so fascinating to see, you know, two films come out within the span of a month, starring Carrie Mulligan, revealing just how much range she has. Because as showy as she is in Promising Young Woman and how like exciting and thrilling that role is, this role here in The Dig is just as understated and just as quiet, but she's always compelling and she always finds unexpected avenues into her character, or she'll give a line delivery that is a little unexpected. And she's always keeping you on your toes. She's always infinitely watchable. And she has a nice chemistry here with Ralph Fiennes. And just there's a quiet and a steady pacing here that allows all these actors to reveal their characters quite organically and to allow those relationships to evolve as this archaeological dig is going on. Lily James and Johnny Flynn are also part of the supporting cast, and they have an interesting relationship. And yeah, it's much more interesting than perhaps it looks on paper. So if you see it pop up there on your Netflix and you're like, oh, I've seen this movie before, maybe you haven't.
The Dig is the film. It is streaming on Netflix. It's rated PG-13, starring Carey Mulligan, Ralph Fiennes, and Lily James, directed by Simon Stone. Our next three films are all national submissions for Oscar consideration. The first is from the nation of Georgia. Beginning is the film. Christy, tell us about this.
So this is yet another feature debut from a woman named Dea. I'm gonna try and get this right because she's a Georgian last name that I don't want to mess up. Kulam Begashvili. And again, like we saw with Rose Glass with St. Maud, it is an incredible debut and so assured and so masterful and chilling in its tone. She will hold a shot for a long time. For a long time, that seems almost unbearable. And the film is shot in the 4:3 ratio, so it's boxy, right? Unlike what we are used to seeing in widescreen, this is a boxier frame. And it makes the events feel that much more claustrophobic and that much more intense. But it takes place in this town outside of Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, where this couple is, they're the head of this Jehovah's Witness church. And it is attacked. And the whole attack takes place within like this long, extended 7-minute long take. And she'll hold it and she will make you watch what is happening. And all throughout, it's these long single takes with the static camera work as the wife in the couple deals with the fallout from that attack and deals with the religious bigotry that they are suffering in this country at this time. And it is absolutely chilling what happens to her and how she emotionally internalizes what that attack meant. And then how she also endures just the misogyny. I mean, shocking, shocking things happen in this film that are, I must warn you, quite triggering. But because it's all shot in this very detached way, often from a distance, like it makes those moments even more harrowing. So this is not an easy watch. This is an incredible talent to watch for the future. So check it out if you have if you're up for it emotionally.
And I'll do my best to pronounce the name of the star, because it sounds like it's quite a performance. Iya Sukashvili is the star of the film Beginning, which is the Nation of Georgia's Oscar submission for consideration. The film is unrated, and you can see it on the video service Mubi. That's M-U-B-I. Beginning is the film. Coming up, we'll hear about the Ukrainian official Oscar submission, the movie Atlantis, which is a sci-fi film, and from Japan, its Oscar submission in the dramatic category, True Mothers. Those and more films coming up on Film Week here on KPCC. It's Film Week on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Angie Hahn and Christy Lemire. We're talking about official Oscars submissions by various countries around the world. We had a couple of major ones last week. This week we have three of them. Next up is the sci-fi drama Atlantis. It's Ukraine's Oscars submission. Angie, we'll start with you to tell us about it.
Yeah, it is a sci-fi film technically in that it's set in 2025, but the world is not really that different from our own. The main thing is that it is set 1 year after the end of the Russo-Ukrainian War, and it follows this vet who has PTSD and gets a job as a truck driver delivering water. I found this one to be so bleak, but also kind of beautiful and not without hope. And it's also really striking the way it is structured and shot. So it is basically a series of vignettes, and each one is composed of a single long shot, usually a stationary wide shot with almost that kind of Wes Anderson-y eye for symmetry. And some of them even feel like short films in and of itself. It's a format that I think might test some people's patience. You're often waiting for something to happen. It can be kind of distancing and alienating. And sometimes not that much happens. There's one where the only thing that happens is a guy takes a bath. But I also think it puts you in the mindset of the main character, that detachment, that uncertainty, that, you know, I don't know what I'm waiting for, but I'm waiting for something. And what eventually emerges is this really quite devastating look at this country that has won a war but lost so much of what they were fighting for. I mean, the land that they fought over is largely uninhabitable, the economy is in shambles, the people are traumatized. And yet there are glimmers of hope that start to show up. So this guy starts to work with an organization that exhumes and identifies the bodies of people who died during the war. And he starts to make a connection with someone who works there. And those tiny little moments of empathy and connection and warmth feel all the more precious because they are so rare. It's hardly the only film, obviously, to examine the cost of war from the perspective of what happens once it's over. But it's done in a way that feels newly chilling to me. I think there's one scene that sums up the movie very well, where the leader of that organization is examining a body and says in very precise clinical detail what he's seeing. Like, oh, shoulder bone detached from, you know, skeleton and stuff like that. And it's a scene that makes you really sit with and look at in a really clear-eyed way what has happened to these people. And it's not that this movie is devoid of emotion at all, just that it's about taking stock of what's happened and then trying to press forward in hopes of a better future.
We're talking about the Ukrainian film Atlantis, which is written and directed by Valentin Vasyanovich. Christy, what do you think of Atlantis?
Yeah, I liked it too. And I think it's tonally and structurally kind of similar to Beginning in that it depicts really harrowing events from a detached kind of tonal perspective. And it just lets you sit in the moment and take it all in. And so things that could have been totally disturbing and shocking, like as Angie mentioned, is this medical examiner taking stock of the, you know, what various skeletal remains look like. It's really understated, and that makes it hit home more than a more melodramatic depiction of the devastation of war, I think. There's a really beautiful visual symmetry from the opening shot to the closing using this infrared, and to see the arc of where this main character comes from the beginning to the end, is, you realize, ultimately quite hopeful. And it is viscerally bleak. But and it is very, very slow. but I really, I can't say I enjoyed it, but I really admire the artistry behind it, and I admire the intent.
Atlantis is Ukraine's Oscar submission in the feature film category. It's unrated, again, written and directed by Valentin Vasyanovich, and you can see it on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Japan's official Oscars submission is the drama True Mothers. It's directed by Naomi Kawase, and she also co-wrote the film with Izumi Takahashi. Christy, what did you think of True Mothers?
Well, this is a film that sounds like the stuff of like a Lifetime Channel movie. You know, it's about a couple that has adopted a little boy, and then the biological mother shows up and wants to take him back. And that sounds like the kind of, you know, shocking melodrama that you would, you know, see on any number of cable channels with any number of C-list stars. But there's great sensitivity here and a kind of complicated flashback structure that elevates it beyond the premise of it. So it's about this couple living in Japan, and they have a little boy, and they seem like they're great parents, and he seems like a good kid. He's in kindergarten. And then they get a call one day from someone who says that she is his mother and she wants him back. And so the film flashes around in time, both to who they were before they had him when they were trying to conceive and having challenges with that. And then also to this young woman and how she got pregnant and what her story is. And it's about all kinds of different mothers, because you have the adoptive mom, and then the biological mom, and then you have this woman who runs this kind of halfway house shelter for these teenage mothers as they are pregnant and about to give birth. And it's quite lovely. It's very sensitive. It has judgment for no one for the decisions that people make here. I think it's just it's a honest and open-hearted exploration of what it takes to be a mom and the decisions that you have to make. So it's quite lovely.
True Mothers is the film from Japan. It's unrated, and it's on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. The documentary Fake Famous is about a number of individuals followed in the film who attempt to become social media influencers, but by using alternative means of doing that. The film is directed by Nick Bilton. Angie, please tell us about Fake Famous.
Alternative means of doing that is such
that euphemistic.
It's such a euphemistic way of saying that the way that they do it is they fake it till they make it.
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, is not just something influencers do. Many of us do that. So it's framed as a social experiment to see if the director, journalist Nick Bilton, and a team of casting directors, stylists, social media experts can take three basically normal people and turn them into legitimate influencers by doing stuff like buying followers, staging phony shoots to make it seem like they have much more glamorous, exciting lives than they already do. And I do appreciate that you get to see, first of all, you get to see how much work it is to be an influencer. I think that a lot of people just have an assumption that it's just people living their lives and taking the occasional photo, but you see, you know, all the planning and organization that goes into it and all the engagement. As one talking head says, it is both the easiest money you'll ever make and the hardest. And I really like the peek behind the curtain at the way that some of these very glitzy seeming photo shoots and so on really look behind the scenes, where a lot of it is just completely phony. Like there's one where one of the influencers is having what looks like a spa day, but it turns out that they just kind of scattered some rose petals around the director's backyard and just had her kind of pose with them and things like that. But I think that to me, it felt a little bit unfocused. It's not really clear what this quote-unquote social experiment is really supposed to be teaching us. I think maybe someone less well-versed in internet culture might find it to be more insightful, but as someone who works for a website, Mashable, that covers a lot of this stuff very much, I didn't personally find that much new or profound here. I kind of wish that it had gone a little bit deeper, more nuanced. It feels like, especially once coronavirus kind of enters the storyline later into the movie, it starts to kind of lose its way a bit and then falls back on a kind of facile influencers are bad kind of messaging. So it's not boring ever, and it's not all bad, but I kind of wished that it had been like a docuseries, something where you could really have room to dig down into the topics it's exploring.
We're talking about the HBO and HBO Max documentary Fake Famous from director Nick Bilton. Christy.
See, Angie, I'm an old So I didn't know all this stuff. So I found a lot of it very eye-opening. I mean, certainly I knew that you could buy followers, but I didn't realize like how much you're constantly having to feed the beast where buying followers is not enough, because if you've got like 100,000 followers, but they're all bots, then like no one is liking your picture or commenting on it. And then that looks conspicuous. So then you got to buy likes and followers, and it's a constant, like, it's like an addiction. You're constantly feeding the beast. So I didn't know that. And I don't know that it necessarily comes up with the conclusion that influencers are bad. I think that there is an appreciation, as Angie says, for the work that goes into it and how it really is like a 24-hour job. It's not just like you put on a pair of $500 Golden Goose sneakers and then you, you know, all of a sudden you have a million likes. I mean, it requires a whole lot more work than that. It was enlightening. It's a very LA movie. It begins at that giant pink wall at the Paul Smith store on Melrose and Harper, like where everyone comes from around the world to take a selfie of themselves in front of it. And it, you know, it's not terribly novel in its interest in exploring the desire for fame. But what is unique about this moment that we are in is that so many people think that this is the easy way to go to get that, you know, and kids now believe that, oh, I'm going to be a YouTube star and that's going to be my job. Like, instead of wanting to be a doctor or a firefighter, like, I want to be a YouTube star. And so I think in trying to get arms around the moment that we are in terms of what counts as cultural currency, like, that's kind of interesting. But I would have liked a deeper exploration as well.
I take issue with you calling yourself an old, but I appreciate it. I appreciate it. Fake Famous is the documentary. It's on the HBO cable channels and streaming on HBO Max starting next Tuesday. It's unrated. The horror thriller The Night features an Iranian-American couple who were trapped inside a hotel. The film is directed by Kirosh Ahari, who also co-wrote the film with Milad Jarmouz. What did you think, Christy, of The Night?
You know, it's got a lot of mood. It's also got a lot of The Shining in it. And there are all kinds of moments and images that are like direct lifts. So I guess if you're going to steal, like, stealing from Kubrick is awesome, you know, ambitious for sure. But the director, he directed it, he co-wrote it, he produced it. I think he also edited it. And it all takes place inside of the Hotel Normandy, at the corner of Normandy and Sixth in K-Town. And it's this couple with their little baby girl, and they're driving home after a night at a friend's house, other Iranians who are living in the United States. And actually, before they even get to the hotel, I found all of that more interesting, where it's just this couple and they're bickering. And the realism to me was actually more compelling than all of the supernatural hoo-ha stuff that takes place in the hotel. But basically they get to the hotel because I won't even get into it, but they spend the night at a hotel on the way home and they can't leave. Like, something is keeping them there, and there are images and haunting moments and secrets that have to come out. And it's all mood. And I don't know that it necessarily adds up.
I'm just glad to hear you use hoo-ha. That's sort of a Peter Rayner. I'm glad to hear you keep that alive. That's a great film reviewer's expression. Malarkey, absolutely. The Night is the film we're talking about. Angie, what did you think?
I think I liked it a little bit more than Christy did without necessarily disagreeing with most of what she said. I'm also noticing that I just happened to notice this is a very LA heavy week of reviews for us. I mean, Little Things, Fake Famous, and now The Night. They're all very LA movies. I think that she is right about the mood being most of what it is. For me, that was mostly enough to carry me through, especially because it's not super long of a movie. I do think it maybe about halfway through or two-thirds through, it starts to feel a little bit repetitive. The mysteries become a little bit more obvious, but the movie doesn't seem to have realized that it's pretty easy to guess what they're hiding. So it does start to lose a little bit of steam around then, but then it finishes pretty strong. I thought that it was really effectively creepy while I was watching it. There were so many times where I was clutching my mouth, not because anything horrible was actually being shown on screen, but just because there was this pervasive sense that something is just off, just wrong, just eerie in some way that is like hard to pinpoint, but that you can feel it and it feels really oppressive. I think that the thematic stuff does not totally work because of the reasons that Christy kind of pinpointed, but I still thought it was a very effective horror movie. I'm glad that I saw it, if only for the chance to spend a very creepy night in the Hotel Normandy.
The Night is directed and co-written by Kurosh Shahari. It stars Shahab Hosseini, Niusha Noor, and Leah Oganyan. The film is unrated, and you can see it at the Vineland Drive-In in the City of Industry or in Hollywood at the Cine Lounge Drive-In. It's also on the Vudu on-demand video platform. And just real quickly, Palmer, which is an Apple TV Plus film starring Justin Timberlake and Juno Temple with Alicia Wainwright. Angie, can you give us like 20 seconds on Palmer?
Yes, it's fine. Justin Timberlake is fine. His relationship with Little Kid is cute. You can guess where pretty much the whole movie is coming from a mile away. If you want to watch Justin Timberlake be kind of cute with a kid for a couple hours, great. If not, you can skip it.
Palmer, Fisher Stevens directing. Cheryl Guerrero is the director. I'm sorry, screenwriter. It's rated R. Again, Palmer is on Apple TV+. Christy Lemire, Angie Hahn, our critics with us this week. Coming up, I'll be talking with writer of the new book, Wild Minds, The Artisan Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. Reed Mittenbuehler will be with me shortly.
A hot cornet can go, sounding hot and blue, but a hot cornet can, like Betty Boop can do. A saxophone can go, playing all night through, but a saxophone can't, like Betty Boop can do.
The theme song for Betty Boop, the animated character. Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us as we look at the history of animation, particularly the golden age of animation. Joining me is Reed Mittenbuehler, author of the new book, Wild Minds, The Artisan Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation. Reed, good to have you with us on Film Week.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's go back to the earliest days of animation and the early studios, some of which, you know, don't exist anymore or merged into the larger studios that would arrive later in 1930s and 40s Hollywood. What was it that led to the initial surge of animation to be shown in movie theaters?
Right. So initially with animation, they were kind of served up as these little hors d'oeuvres, right? Like a little amuse-bouche before the main meal. When people went to go see movies before the main feature started, you'd get served, you know, a short film, short documentaries, things like that, and then a short animated cartoon, usually about 7 minutes long, a little comedy. And that's how they started.
And were those early animated films, the shorts, were they largely comedic or did they get into more serious subject matter?
Well, often in the very, very earliest days, like that's what they evolved to within the first few years. But the very first animators like Winsor McKay, he had started as a newspaper cartoonist. So he often tackled subjects that were very serious related to politics or the economy, like he would in his cartoons for the Hearst Empire. He would look at the psychology of dreams through Little Nemo and Slumberland. He took on the sinking of the Lusitania around World War I. His vision for animation was actually, you know, that this is something that someday people would go to museums and they, instead of seeing paintings, would see cartoons, paintings that move. But very quickly it became comedic because it was very expensive to make those really long, really to make those cartoons like Winsor McKay was making. And it also needed to be economically feasible. And the best way to do that was to get audiences in and audiences enjoying them. And that was through comedy. But in those early days, it actually was very serious, very serious endeavor.
Well, and you tell early on in the book the story of the development of Felix the Cat, a character that for many of us who were baby boomers grew up with the Felix the Cat cartoons on television, black and white, one after the other, cobbled together in syndication, shown after school typically. But the early Felix the Cats, apparently very different sort of a tone. Describe the origins of the character.
Right. So the character, there was an animator named Otto Mesmer. And Otto Mesmer was from New Jersey, just on the other side of the river from New York, the Hudson River. And he had started as a cartoonist, newspaper cartoonist. And this is the very early days of cinema when it was really before it had fully established itself in Hollywood. And a lot of the studios were in New York or they were in New Jersey. And he went to try to get a job as a scene background painter, that sort of thing. And they're like, look, this new animation thing is going on. So you know, why don't you try your hand at that? And so he tried his hand at that in the very earliest days. And then he got pulled into World War I. And he spent World War I in the trenches and saw a lot of pretty traumatic, pretty terrible things. And when he came back, got a job working for a man named Pat Sullivan. And Paramount, or the predecessor of Paramount, Famous Players Lasky, they were looking for some cartoons, and he came up with the idea of Felix the Cat. But in those early Felix the Cat cartoons, he would channel a lot of his experiences from the war. Later in cartoons, you never see characters die necessarily. You know, if an anvil falls in their head or dynamite goes off, they don't die. But in those very early ones, he would actually show characters dying, like permanently, X's for eyes. And he would show things like his characters coming back from war and their girlfriends had left him, you know, as a way to kind of explore his experiences that way. And a lot, and the very first one called Feline Follies, before Felix even had his name, he actually commits suicide in that cartoon. So they would take on some pretty dark, dark material, very different than what I think people think of cartoons today as being back then.
Yeah. So when did that shift occur, or about what period of time from where darker material wasn't considered acceptable for cartoons? All of these, of course, we should mention, were aimed at general audiences, largely at adults.
Right, largely at all of the real big names in animation, including Walt Disney, during that first 50 years, they were pretty adamant about the fact that we're making cartoons for adults or ourselves, not for children. It's not that they didn't want children to enjoy them. It was just when children did enjoy them, they enjoyed them in the same way that they enjoyed, say, a Charlie Chaplin movie, you know, something made for adults that children could also enjoy, something that worked on many different levels. And the period of time where you'd see this kind of material in cartoons was really the first 50 years. You know, certainly there were varying degrees of that kind of darkness and those subversive themes, but it was television when they really started dropping that. Like before, cartoons had been shown in theaters where the money was generated by adults paying ticket prices as, you know, these little features before the main feature. But with television, now they're being shown in homes where you have a lot of kids around, especially with the baby boomers, you know, just being born in those first years of television. And the revenue is being generated by advertisers who are now wanting a say and what's up on those screens. And it was a sea change almost overnight. People started thinking about cartoons as something they could focus directly for kids, because Saturday morning was the dead space. It was like no one watched television. So you've got programmers like, well, what could we put on TV? And they saw all of these old cartoons. And like, well, we could just recycle those. But they started censoring them and editing them, cutting them to make them a little more palatable for children. And then you've got the advertisers who are like, okay, well, if kids are watching these early on a Saturday morning, or their kids are basically, or their parents are basically using televisions as surrogate babysitters, what are those kids going to be most susceptible to advertising-wise? And the answer came to them like a bolt of lightning. Well, how about sugary breakfast cereals and toys, that kind of thing? And then that this new culture around animation suddenly emerged and took hold for several decades afterwards.
Well, and you've got a character like Betty Boop, for example, whose theme song we heard at the beginning of our conversation, who was quite risque early on. I think there was even nudity in the early Betty Boop cartoons, wasn't there? And then, of course, by the time it arrives on television, it's she's quite sanitized.
Right. Very, very different, especially the time it arrived on television, which by that time, the character's rights had exchanged hands several times. So you had a very different group of people who were making those cartoons or using her as a character than in the early days when it was the Fleischer brothers, the Fleischer studio that had created her. And Betty in those very early days was very, very risque. But what was most interesting about her, this is before the Hays Code, 1934, you know, the Hays Code being the group of rules that studios adopted kind of to self-censor. A lot of protest groups were worried about unsavory images on the screen, too much sexuality. They weren't as much concerned with violence as they were with sexuality. And so they put together a group of rules. Betty, in those very early days of her existence, you would see her, you know, the Zaftig figure, very sexual, but you would also see her in roles where she'd be, say, running for president, she'd be a doctor, she'd be an aviator, roles that people at the time didn't always, you know, think were proper for women. But after the Hays Code went into effect, you see Betty's clothing become a little more modest, you see her hemlines getting a little lower, that sort of thing. But you also see her less likely to be involved in those roles, running for president and that sort of thing. And her popularity plummeted as a result. And by the time you get to the middle to the late 1930s, her run as a cartoon star was pretty much over.
Yeah, it's kind of like, what's this popularity all about by the time they had changed the character so dramatically? We're talking with Reed Mittenbuehler, author of Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries that inspired the Golden Age of Animation. As we continue, we're going to be talking about some of the technology that was employed that made animated characters look more realistic in the early years of animation. We'll also talk about the rise of Warner Brothers and its cartoon unit and some of the great animators there, Chuck Jones, Friz Freleng, and others, and the characters that they created that we still enjoy today. Of course, we listen to Popeye's theme song. We'll continue on Film Week here on 89.3 KPECC and the KPECC app. Week on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Of course, you're listening to music from Walt Disney's classic Fantasia, released in 1940, considered a bold experiment combining classical music with animation. Joining us to talk about animation and its evolution is the author of Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation, Reed Mittenbuehler, joining us. What was some of the technology that dramatically changed the way animated characters could be depicted?
So there are quite a few. One of the first major ones was the rotoscope, invented by Max Fleischer. And this was a device that allowed the animators to record a person or an animal or whatever moving, and then they could trace that movement. And so you see that employed early on. But soon, a lot of animators actually started to reject it, because one of the advantages of animation is that it's not reality, that you can do crazy kind of surreal things. So a lot of them actually started to stop using the rotoscope in favor of creating characters that were a little more wild and extreme and rubbery, you know, and that sort of thing. But one of my favorite examples of technology changing cartoons is that in the 1920s, you had a few stars like Felix the Cat. But by the end of the 1920s, cartoons were just on the brink of going out of existence. They weren't particularly popular. A lot of audiences thought they were kind of gimmicky. They weren't really sure. And this is in the silent era. But once sound comes into cartoons, it renewed their life, because a lot of the movie studios owned music production companies and music catalogs, and they were looking for a way to create ancillary income by promoting their music catalogs. So a lot of them said, you know, as long as you can get a couple of our songs into this cartoon, you can kind of do whatever you want, which liberated a lot of animators to really experimental in the themes that they tackled, just as long as they got a couple of those songs in there. So that really helped animation. And then the next real big wave in technology came with television. And television, it's a little bit like the internet today. It's big, huge space. It needed to be filled. And that kind of created an environment that prioritized quantity over quality.
So you get the Hanna-Barbera model of animation, with multiple series running simultaneously and somewhat more of an assembly line approach.
Right. And the characters are a little more blocky. You know, compare that to, say, Pinocchio, you know, which was made much earlier, where, I mean, every one of those frames is a little painting unto itself. But they just had to make more of it for the television era, and that really reduced the quality.
One thing I just want to mention, you mentioned the Fleischer brothers, and, you know, of course, we tend to be aware here in Los Angeles that the studio founders were for the most part Jewish immigrants, and many of the themes that they adopt in the early films are highly American, quote unquote, and it's sort of, you know, the process of Americanizing the country. What's interesting is in many of these early animated films made by Jewish animators is that they brought Jewish culture into the art.
Yes, they did. And that's one of the really interesting things about animation as a subset of greater Hollywood history is that it stayed New York-based for a really long time. A lot of the studios were in New York because their talent pools came out of the newspapers, and New York was the print media empire. And when Walt Disney, who was from the Midwest, was first deciding, where do I go? Do I go to the East Coast or do I go to the West Coast? He ultimately decided on the West Coast because his brother Roy was there recuperating from tuberculosis, but also the studios were there. But he thought for a long time, you know, maybe I should go to New York, because that's really where it's all at. And that's where you see these competing visions for what America is kind of starting to arise too. You've got Walt in the West with, you know, he liked to favor certain rural kinds of scenes and that sort of thing drawn from his upbringing. And then you go to the East Coast and you've got studios like the Fleischers that a lot of them had grown up on the Lower East Side or in Brooklyn, and they are drawing in those experiences and they really integrated them into their cartoons in a lot of very kind of sly, subversive ways. And it's interesting to see these coded messages hidden in their work.
That's funny. Snow White was Disney's first full-length animated feature, released in 1938. Let's listen to Snow White. White wakes up the seven dwarfs.
Why, you little man! How do you do? I said, how do you do?
How do you do what?
Oh, you can talk! I'm so glad!
That from Snow White, 1938, which was a groundbreaking film when Disney's whole company really hung in the balance here, didn't it, Reed? Talk with us about the degree of accomplishment Snow White represented and the acclaim that came its way.
Absolutely. You know, one of my favorite stories about Snow White is that Walt Disney, when he was, you know, his first few years in Hollywood weren't particularly successful. And he's working away in animation, and he wanted to raise animation to a higher level. He wanted people to respect it at the same level they did live action. And one day he was on a train and he meets a man, and they just start up a random chat. And I was like, what part of the movie business are you in? And when he says cartoons, the man crinkles his nose. And Walt Disney knew right then, he was, I need to make people respect this. And Snow White was one of the ways he wanted to do that. He wanted to create, you know, the first real mainstream. There had been a couple long feature-length cartoons before in Europe and elsewhere, but he wanted to create really the first big one in America that would put it on par with live action. And when it came out, it was the most successful movie financially ever at that point, and critically acclaimed almost entirely across the board. And people didn't see it as a kid's movie either. In fact, in England, parents were warned, like, you know, kids shouldn't see this movie without you. And there's always a story that circulated about the movie's premiere at Radio City Music Hall in New York, saying, you know, that after it aired, they had to replace a lot of the upholstery because so many kids had wet their pants while watching it.
So we don't know if that's true or not, but it's a great promotional story for the film, of course. And then Fantasia, we played the selection coming into the segment, released in 1940, which very experimental. And this kind of speaks as well to the collaborations and rivalries that you write about here. Tell us just a brief story here related to Fantasia.
Right. So with Fantasia, what's really was interesting to me is that Walt Disney in those first 20 years, you know, today, sometimes people use the term Disneyfication as a little bit of a pejorative, right? But it's not always fair. Walt Disney in those first 20 years was a very bold artist. He had a lot of artists like Salvador Dali, Thomas Hart Benton, Thomas Mann, circulating around the studio, talking to his artists. And with Fantasia, he collaborated with Leopold Stokowski, who's the conductor of the Philadelphia Symphony Orchestra. And Walt Disney and Leopold Stokowski both shared a kind of vision for taking something that was seen as a high art, classical music, and bringing it down to the masses and making it popular. Walt Disney, his role in working with animation, he had historically worked with something that was seen as more popular, and he wanted to raise it to a high art. So you have this collaboration between these two people working on this film that, you know, with a similar goal of really introducing people to art and helping them see it in a different way. And it was this wild collaboration. A lot of Disney's animators really didn't care for Stokowski. They saw him as a little bit arrogant, as a little bit pretentious. One of them even joked, you know, maybe we could call it Habrowski by Stokowski.
All right. Well, there's so many great stories that are included, and we'll have to save the story about Warner Brothers Animation for a future time, but that's detailed as well. In our guest Reed Mittenbuehler's book, Wild Minds, The Artists and Rivalries That Inspired the Golden Age of Animation, for all of us at Film Week, have a great weekend.